Why don't you go ahead and turn to the book of James with me this morning. As I mentioned, we're going to be starting a new series on the book of James. And while we are doing this, Dustin and I are getting together every week and we are studying through Exodus together to prepare for when we do Exodus. And that's actually been pretty exciting, too, to do that. So, but I need to, I mentioned to you that Dustin and even my wife Amy have been sort of prodding me to teach on the book of James. Which I don't know that I've taught on it once before. My pattern has always been, I figure there's 66 books, who knows how much time I have. So I always try to do something new, preach through something I've never preached through before. It's not too often I go back and reteach through something I've already taught on before, because again, I figure I've got 66 books to make it through. but I don't know when. I don't ever remember teaching on James. I just know I had some notes on it, so I know I've done that years ago. But so this will be fun for me. There's some interesting stuff relating to James that partly is why Dustin wanted me to do it here. James is probably my favorite book. If I have a favorite book in the New Testament, it's going to be the book of James. And part of the reason for that is because, after my first year of seminary, the way seminary is structured out, you have your, at least at Grace, because Grace was fairly heavy on the languages. So it's one of the reasons I chose the school. So you have your first full year of Greek, your first semester, or first year, and then you start your second year of Greek and your first year of Hebrew, and then pretty much for the rest of seminary, you've got Greek and Hebrew going back and forth. But you have that first year of Greek, and it's all basically understanding the Greek language. And then when you start your second year, you start what are called your exegesis classes. So exegesis has to do with drawing out from the text. So you have your language first, and then you have what's called a hermeneutics, which is a study of how to interpret the Word of God. And then after you get all that groundwork sort of done, then they say, now it's time to put it into practice. And so you start your exegesis classes, which is where you're going into text and you're translating it, but then you're also trying to draw out meaning from it, and then you write papers on it, stuff like that. Well, after my first year of Greek, I decided that for the summer, I was going to translate the book of James. And I hadn't even gotten to that point yet. We hadn't started the exegesis courses yet, so I was fairly raw. So I basically said, you know what, I'm going to jump ahead, and I'm going to start working on the book of James myself and writing my own translation of the book of James. And I figured it would be good for me to exercise what I had been learning. And part of it was because I knew being away from Greek for 3 months in the summer, it was going to be hard to come back in for the second year. So I thought it would keep me fresh. Well, back then we didn't have anything on computers at all except maybe some word processing. So I would have my, if you walked into my living room at the time, you would see books scattered because there were all the Greek lexicons, which are like dictionaries in the Greek New Testament, and paper spread all over the place, and a couple of commentaries. And so I would come home and I would literally lay on the floor and translate the book of James. And I did that over the course of that summer. And so through that process, I just really fell in love with that aspect of, what they refer to as exegesis, drawing out the meaning, where I was so focused on, I want to understand what did James write and what does it mean? And that's really the heart of it. That's what you're supposed to do as a teacher and a preacher. And so for me, it really began with the book of James. And so the other side of that is, over the last 30 or so plus years, I've actually helped other individuals learn to study by using the book of James. I put together my own little system, if you will, where I use the book of James to teach people all the tools necessary to interpret the Bible. And I actually did that with Dustin. So Dustin and I spent, 6 months together, years ago, working through the book of James. And then we got done with that, and he's like, I want to keep doing this. So we went into 1 Timothy and 2 Timothy and did the same sort of thing. And so it's got a kind of a neat place for both Dustin and I, because of working through it together, but because of the work that I did on it as well. So, again, it's one of my favorite books. It's extremely practical, but again, it holds that kind of a dear place for me because it's really the first real seminary-level exegesis that I did, meaning working with the languages and kind of having to work through that and struggle through that and ask a lot of hard questions, because there's some hard stuff in James. In hindsight, it probably wasn't the best book to start with. But it was a good book to start with, and God knew. So we're going to dive into it today and, again, do some introductory stuff. Again, I'll try to make this a little bit more interactive. We're going to look at primarily the first two verses today, and we're going to digest as best we can those two verses and come up with our background information. I'm going to take off my sweater here just because it's a little warm. Won't be too much longer. I won't be able to wear the short sleeves. So, James chapter 1, look at the first two verses with me. It says, James, a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad, greetings. So that's our introduction. We'll use that as sort of our basis here. You already know, by turning to the book of James, you know that it's one of the epistles in the New Testament. You have the four Gospels, which are one particular genre. You've got the book of Acts, which is like a history book. Then you have what might be referred to as a seminary dissertation in the book of Romans. It's very technical. And then you get basically the letters, the epistles, and that's exactly what they are. They're just letters. And so this is a letter that James wrote to a particular group of individuals. And we find out specific information as we look at this. So I want you to look at that. The very first word tells us who wrote this. Happens to be an individual by the name of James. Now, I'm going to throw this out to you. How many James are there in the New Testament? Anybody know?
Five.
Some say five, some say four. But yeah, there's at least four, maybe five. Okay? So part of our job is to figure out, well, which James is this? So, there are two very, I won't call them famous, but we know two of the James were associated with a pretty famous individual. You know who that is? Jesus. We basically, there are two James that were apostles of Christ. One of them is James, son of Zebedee. He's the brother of John. And then there's James, son of Alphaeus. He was also called James the Less. So you have James, the brother of John, who was referred to as James the Great. And then you have another James, James the Less. So they were two disciples. We actually see them listed multiple times together. Acts chapter 1, verse 13 lists them as well as individuals. Matthew chapter 4, verse 21, a couple other places. So we know that two of the James in the New Testament were disciples of Jesus. There's another James, and he's not well known, but James, the father of Judas. Judas, not Iscariot, but one of the other disciples of Jesus was named Judas. And his father happens to be James as well. We don't know much about him. Does anybody else know there's another James? Anybody? Yeah. The half-brother of Jesus was the other fairly prominent individual. So we have at least those four. So the question we have to figure out is, which one of those individuals wrote this letter? Anybody know what the general consensus is? Like historically what people have thought?
Which one it was.
Yeah, which James it was?
Exactly.
Yeah, most, you know, from a historical standpoint, the church throughout its history believes that this letter was written by the half-brother of Jesus. Part of that is because in the first century, we all know the historian Josephus. Josephus attributed the letter to James. Well, he was pretty close. He's writing somewhere probably within 30, 40 years of the crucifixion of Christ. He would have been right in the thick of all this. Most believe that this book of James was maybe written about the 40s or 50s, maybe a decade or two after Jesus had died. So Josephus was fairly well-respected scholar, historian. Another famous historian, Eusebius, he was a 3rd century historian. He was actually referred to as the father of church history. He wrote the first history of the early church outside of the book of Acts. And he also attributed this to Jesus, the half-brother of James. So if we just want to look at the two people that probably knew best, we would also come to the same conclusion. That's the position that I hold. Again, most scholars hold that position. So the question is, what do we know about the half-brother of Jesus? And why would he write this letter? Well, we can follow a thread throughout the scripture. Anybody, what's the first thing we learned about James, the half-brother of Jesus, in the Gospels? Anybody know? There's a particular episode. I want you to turn to John chapter 7. John chapter 7, we're going to look at the first five verses. But just so you understand, we'll kind of throw this out there. Jesus had four half-brothers. James was the oldest. Then they had Joseph, Simon, and Judas. Those are all mentioned in Matthew chapter 13. So Jesus had at least four half-brothers and a couple of sisters. The sisters are not named, but we know that there are some sisters because it's plural. So he happens to have been the oldest of Jesus' half-brothers. So I'll turn to John chapter 7 with me. And let's look at the first five verses or so. I got to get there myself. John chapter 7. First five verses or so. After these things, Jesus was walking in Galilee, for he was unwilling to walk in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now the feast of the Jews, the feast of Booths, was near. Therefore his brothers, that would include, we're going to assume, they kind of seem to move as a unit. Because every time the brothers are mentioned in the New Testament, in the Gospels, it's usually his brothers as a group. So we would assume that James is part of this. But therefore his brothers said to him, "Leave here and go into Judea, so that your disciples also may see your works which you are doing. For no one does anything in secret when he himself seeks to be known publicly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." And look at verse 5. "For not even his brothers were believing in him." Those first four verses or so, most understand those to be a form of mockery. They're mocking him. You want to be famous? You want to make disciples? Well, then really shouldn't you go down there to Jerusalem? That's what famous people do. That's what you do to make disciples. But it's clear that they didn't actually believe him. They didn't trust that he was who he claimed to be. Look at Mark chapter 3, verse 20. We see something else, too. Mark chapter 3, verse 20. This is after Jesus had been choosing his disciples, and it says in verse 20, "And he came home, and the crowd gathered again to such an extent that they could not even eat a meal." And it says here, when his own people, this is the word for kin, when his own kin, it's likely his family itself. When his own kin, people, if you want, heard of this, they went out to take custody of him, for they were saying, "He's lost his marbles. He's lost his senses." That was a perspective that his brothers had. So not only did they mock him, not only did they not believe him, but they thought he was crazy. So that was James. That's where he was when Christ was alive. However, what we learn is that by the time we get to the first chapter of Acts, he's with the disciples, praying together. Somehow, in some way, James came to finally believe that Jesus was who he said he was. But not only that, not only did he become a believer, but he became probably the most prominent leader in Jerusalem of the church. And we see that thread throughout the book of Acts. Before I start there, though, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 6, you don't have to turn there. But the question you have to ask is, so what happened to him? You know, was it just enough that he saw Christ die and then heard about him appearing? Was that enough to convert James? Was that enough to convince him? Well, Paul says that Jesus actually appeared to James. And he appeared to James before the rest of the apostles. You think maybe Jesus had a conversation with him? I think that's why James probably became the leader that James was in the church. I believe that was part of that conversation. I'm speculating there. But Paul makes a point of saying he appeared to James and then the apostles. And so I believe that it was that event. It wasn't just that Jesus had risen from the dead, but that he took time to meet specifically with James that convinced James that Jesus was who he said he was. And then we see his role in the early church. We're going to go through Acts, a couple of different places in Acts. So you want to turn to Acts chapter 1, verse 14. The first thing we see there, Acts chapter 1, verse 14, is that he's with the disciples in that upper room. So Acts chapter 1, verse 14, these all with one mind were continually devoting themselves to prayer, along with the women, and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and then look at this, and with his brothers. So they're all in the upper room together. They're all of one mind. They're all devoted. They're all praying together. They're waiting to see what's next. Because remember, they were told to wait in Jerusalem till the Holy Spirit ultimately would come. And there the brothers are, hanging out with the disciples, intimately familiar with all that was going on. So he's in the upper room with them. Turn to Acts chapter 12, verse 17. Acts chapter 12, verse 17. After Peter had been arrested and was miraculously led out of prison by the angel, you remember that? He runs off to Jerusalem there. He needs to report what's happening. But look at Acts chapter 12, verse 17. It says, we'll start in verse 16. But Peter continued knocking. He's out of the door. You remember that situation where he's knocking on the door and they, you know, weren't going to let him in? Little servant girl's a little freaked out. Well, but Peter continued knocking, and when they had opened the door, they saw him and were amazed. But motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had led him out of the prison. And he said, and check this out, report these things to James. Report these things to James and the brethren. And he left and went to another place. Now, why do you suppose that's important that he said, what does that tell us about James if Peter's saying, hey, make sure you go tell James? What does that tell us? Probably holds a prominent role, right? That's what we would assume. Jump down to Acts chapter 15. Do you remember what happened when the controversy over Gentiles in the church and some of the Jews saying that they had to obey the law and everything else? And so Paul went to Jerusalem to meet with the elders at Jerusalem, figure out what we need to do. And so Acts chapter 15, verses 13 through 21. After they had stopped speaking, and who is it that does the talking now? James answered, saying, brethren, listen to me. Simon has related how God first concerned himself about taking from among the Gentiles a people for his name. With this, the words of the prophets agree, just as it is written. So you can follow that conversation. James is the one that stands up and basically issues the counsel. You have Peter there and you have the other apostles there, but James is the one that ultimately says, here's what we need to do. This is what God expects of the Gentiles. So clearly that tells us that he's got, again, a prominent role in Jerusalem among the apostles, especially since he's the one that's doing the speaking. How about Acts chapter 21? A few years later, Paul specifically seeks out James and the elders at Jerusalem to report to them what God was doing among the Gentiles. So it went from, how do we handle this with the Gentiles, to Paul now coming back and reporting, you won't believe what God is doing among the Gentiles. And he makes a specific point of seeking out James. Acts chapter 21. You jump down to verse 15. After these days, we got ready and started on our way up to Jerusalem. Some of the disciples from Caesarea also came with us, taking us to Mnason of Cyprus, a disciple of long standing with whom we are to lodge. After we arrived in Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. And the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and the elders were present. So again, Luke actually makes a specific reference to Paul seeking out James here. Why? Because James was apparently the leader of the Jerusalem church, or at least a very prominent individual, maybe one of, if we can say it that way. Further evidence of this, of his role there, in Galatians 1:19, Paul refers to James as one of the apostles, actually calls him an apostle. Typically, that word apostle, not always, but usually it's a reference to somebody who had seen Christ after his resurrection. Well, James did, because Jesus appeared to him. But also in Galatians chapter 2, verse 9, Paul refers to James along with Peter and John as being supposed pillars of the church at Jerusalem. So what we see basically is that James was a fairly prominent figure within Jerusalem. He was named among the apostles. He was named among the elders. Gave wise counsel. According to history, he earned the nickname. Anybody know what it is? You have James the Great, James the Less, and now you have this other James. Notice.
Camel knees.
What's that?
Camel knees.
Camel knees. Yeah. I don't know where it came from. Anybody know the background of that?
Evidently, he was so often in prayer to God on his knees that his knees looked like camel knees.
Yeah. What a great reputation, huh? He was also referred to as James the Just. Just a just individual. That's what history has to say about him. Anybody know when he was martyred? Because he was martyred. They say probably around AD 62. Sometimes knowing what happened to... I've got a great book at home. It's about that thick, not real thick. But it's called After Acts. And it basically traces what history says about each of the apostles and how they died. And most of that is all just found in different writings here and there. And some of what we've heard, it probably can't be substantiated historically. Some of it can be. So it's a great book because it kind of grades everything. It tells you, here's what everybody thinks, you know, happened to Paul or happened to Peter or happened to James. And here's what we can prove. And it has a little checklist at the end of every section. And grades, you know, with letters, A, B, C, D, whether or not you can trust that particular legend of their death. Well, what we learn about James is says that, in fact, you find this in 1st, 2nd, 3rd century historians, that James was summoned by the Pharisees at the request of the high priest Ananus. Ananus was not happy, and he accused James of breaking the Jewish law. So what these historians have told us is that the scribes and the Pharisees actually took him up to the pinnacle of the temple and demanded that he renounce his faith in Christ. That's written by a number of different theologians. By histories, yeah. So, took him up to the temple, told him to renounce his faith in Jesus. When he refused, they pushed him off the pinnacle. But somehow, he miraculously survived. While he was on the ground, historians tell us that he began to pray using the words of Jesus, God, forgive them for they don't know what they do. Sounds an awful lot like Stephen. And while he was doing that, they proceeded to stone him to death. And then one historian says that to finish him off, there happened to have been a man in the crowd who was a launderer for a living, washed clothes, and they used these particular clubs to beat the clothes, beat the dust out of them and whatnot, and that individual delivered a blow to James' head, and that's what finally killed him. Now that's what history, tradition tells us. Whether or not all those details are right, like I said, there are multiple historians in the first three centuries that all repeat that, but it's possible that there may be some embellishment there. We don't know. But the reality of it is we do know that he was martyred. Martyred for his faith. Probably, again, around AD 60, 62, somewhere in there. Now, I want to go back to James chapter 1. Because look, when we consider all of this, he's the half-brother of Jesus. That's a pretty cool thing, right? That would get you some clout, would it not? He happens to have been the leader at Jerusalem, probably. That would get you some clout. You know, how many pastors or Christian leaders do we see today with letters after their name? You know, you buy one of their books and it'll list all their credentials in the back of it. You know, that's usually what we do, right? Because it gives us some cred. How does James introduce himself here in the book of James? He says, a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. He doesn't say, James, brother of Jesus, leader at Jerusalem. Why do you suppose he did that? Why not take advantage? Why not live a little bit off that relationship with Christ? That familial connection, or the fact that he had all this credibility because of his roles in Jerusalem. Anybody have a thought?
Because he knew. I mean, he's just living by the life of another. He knew it. He knew that it was Christ.
Yeah, I mean, this is a humble And it kind of reminds us of what Paul does. I mean, how many times does Paul simply say, bondservant of God and Jesus Christ? There's a humility that's there, which may kind of explain, you know, why he was the leader that he was. But I think, you know, it's, again, we're speculating a little bit, but he refers to himself first as a bondservant, a slave of God and of Christ. Think about that for a moment. A servant of your own brother. Isn't that a bit interesting? But you notice what else he does there? How does he refer to Christ? Lord. Yeah. That, it's pretty significant, I think, too. He recognized, here he is, the brother of the Messiah. And yet, the way that he introduces himself is, I'm a servant to both God and my Lord.
Under the inspiration of the Lord.
Absolutely, yeah. But it's a very humble thing. Anyway, so that's pretty much what we know about James. This letter is written by the half-brother of Christ, leader of the church of Jerusalem. Happened to have seen Christ after his resurrection. Again, I think that there's some significance to that. You know, remember what he told Peter about Peter having the keys to the kingdom? I wonder if there was a similar conversation with James, that James, here's how I'm going to use you. We don't know for sure. It's some speculation. But he also appears to be rather humble, and we're going to see that in the way that he writes as well. So that actually then takes us to the recipients. Who's he writing to and why is he writing to them? We see this in verse 2. Or not verse 2. We see it in the second half of verse 1. To the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad, greetings. And then he says, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. So, what's the first thing that stands out in that second phrase to you there? First couple of words, what does that tell us? Who's it addressed to? Yeah, the 12 tribes. That would be who?
Israel,
right? So he's writing to Jews, fellow Jews, which James was a Jew. Obviously. So we know that. In fact, it's used multiple times. That way you can look. I'll give you the citations. But Matthew chapter 19, verse 28, Acts chapter 26, verse 7, Revelation chapter 7, verse 4, all refer to the 12 tribes. We know that that is a reference specifically to Israel, to Hebrews, to Jews. So we know that he's writing to fellow Jews here. Now, there's a second thing he says about these individuals. Did you catch what that is? Yeah, it says, who are dispersed or scattered abroad. That's actually a single Greek word. It's the word diaspora. If you were to translate this more literally, it would be to those who are in the diaspora. That referred to the area outside of Israel. In fact, it was primarily a Gentile area. So it's not just outside Jerusalem, but it's actually outside of Israel. So he's writing to Jews who are outside of what was at that time Israel. Peter, turn to 1 Peter chapter 1. He does something very similar. He actually gives us a little bit more geographic details. 1 Peter chapter 1, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens, scattered throughout, and then the same word he used there is diaspora. But he says, to those who reside as aliens, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. So, it kind of gives you a geographic idea, but these were all Gentile areas, Greek areas. There's another interesting comment. It's, in fact, if you want, turn there to John chapter 7 related to this. Jesus was actually asked about this region. John chapter 7, verse 35. I'm making you work today. Jesus is basically, he just finished saying, for a little while longer I'm with you, and then I go to him who sent me. You will seek me and you will not find me, and where I am you cannot come. And then in verse 35, the Jews said to one another, where does this man intend to go that we will not find him? He's not intending to go to the diaspora among the Greeks and teach the Greeks, is he? So that was a known region. Again, it was the area outside of Jerusalem. It was a Greek area, and Jews were actually scattered throughout that area. Couple of different explanations as to why they might have been scattered throughout there. You remember the Assyrians and the Babylonians? Remember Daniel? They were taken away into captivity. Well, they were taken outside of Israel. And so there were many Jews, we were told this in the scriptures, that never returned back to Israel. They were still living out in the diaspora. However, it's also possible, both in Acts chapter, what is it, 9? Acts chapter 12 with Herod. Do you remember what happened when Paul began to persecute, or when Saul began to persecute the church? They scattered, didn't they? What's that?
All except
the apostles. Exactly, yeah. And it says they scattered, they went out, they started preaching the gospel. We get to Acts chapter 12, well, we find Herod, and Herod noticed that, hey, arrested, you know, one James and killed James, and it satisfied the people. That was a different James. But satisfied the people, and he arrested Peter. Well, there was a pretty significant persecution of Christians at that time as well that caused people to scatter. And so it's possible that what James is addressing here are individuals who had scattered because of that. It could have been Jews that were simply living in the diaspora that never came back after the, you know, were basically descendants of those who had did not come back after the Babylonian and Syrian captivities. Or could have just been that these were individuals that were scattered. And that kind of hints at the other thing that we know about these individuals. If you look at James chapter 2, or James chapter 1, look at verse 2. Is there anything there that tells us a little bit about who these people were? I'm making you exercise this morning. How does he refer to them in verse 2? My brethren. Now, what's interesting about this, and there's some debate, Jews referred to one another as brethren. In fact, we have examples of that. Peter, at Pentecost, addressed the Jews in the audience as brethren. So that was something that they did. Jews used that as well because they had that religious link, if you will. But I think James is using it here in the other way that we find in the New Testament, which is when Christians are referred to by one another as brethren. And the reason for that is, turn to James chapter 2, verse 1. Notice what he says here. My brethren, do not hold your faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism. So he specifically refers to them as having a faith in Jesus Christ. Jump over to chapter 5. He does it one more time. James chapter 5, verses 7 and 8. Therefore, he says, be patient, brethren, until what? The coming of the Lord. The farmer waits for the precious produce of the soil, being patient about it until it gets the early and the late rains. You too be patient. Strengthen your hearts for what? The coming of the Lord is near. So the third thing we learn here about his recipients is that they were Jewish believers. He's pretty confident of that. Now, we're going to find that, like almost any letter, the authors would address them as if they're all saved, even though there may be some that are not saved in the audience or the recipients. It's much like the same thing with the church. Every Sunday when I get up here and teach, I'm going to address you as if you're saved without knowing if every one of you is saved. I'm pretty confident. And you folks. But the average church, we have to make the assumption that there's a fair number of people that are unsaved in that audience, even though they may pretend or confess or whatever. And so we'll see that in the book of James too, that they weren't always behaving like they were saved, and there may have been some that weren't. But he addresses them as if they're all saved, because he refers to their faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. So, we know that they were Jews. We know that they were scattered outside of Israel and outside of Jerusalem, or outside of Israel. We know that they're believers, or at least profess to be believers. There's one final thing, and it doesn't stand out in the introduction here, but it becomes really apparent as we go through the letter. One final thing we know about these recipients is that they were a mess. They were struggling. All kinds of divisions. all kinds of trials, probably of their own making. There was conflict between rich and poor. There was partiality in the way that they treated one another. There was bickering. There was fighting. There was envy. There was greed. There were quarrels and conflicts. There's even reference to somebody being murdered. And I take that as a literal thing in this book. Not everyone does. They were a mess. And that actually is why James wrote the letter. You know, it's interesting because with epistles, there's usually a reason, a motivation for writing the letter. Think about 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians, Paul was written a letter. They asked him about different topics, including things like sexual immorality, marriage and divorce, lawsuits among believers, the Lord's Supper, all kinds of stuff, the spiritual gifts. So Paul wrote 1 Corinthians to answer all those questions. 2 Corinthians he wrote because they weren't treating him properly. Think about Galatians. They'd all started to fall prey to the law and became legalistic, so Paul wrote Galatians to correct that. You know, you've got the book of Ephesians, which has different issues that are addressed. You've got 1 and 2 Timothy written for very specific purposes. So every letter has a purpose and a reason. And boy, the stuff that we find in this letter, these people are a mess. Here's some of the topics that James has to cover. Okay, he talks about trials and temptations. He talks about being a doer of the word because they weren't practicing the word. He talks about how to treat orphans and widows. He talks about partiality, living out your faith without partiality, how you treat people. He talks about faith versus works. He talked about teachers and the abuse of the tongue. He talked about what it meant to have true wisdom. He addresses them on their quarrels and their conflicts that they're having with each other. He talks to them about greed and the pursuit of riches. Talks about needing to be patient with those that are oppressing them. Lastly, you get into the last section of the book, he talks about suffering and sickness that was likely a cause of their own sin. So you got this long hodgepodge list of all these different topics, and it's because they were struggling with all of these things. So again, these people were kind of a mess. So in many respects, he's writing them, telling them how to fix the mess that they had created by not living like they should have been living as believers. And so he's trying to correct that. So in that respect, it's a form of encouragement. He's going to help them get through the trials that they're having because of these behavior issues. And he expects them to correct it. And as we go through that, we're going to see there are times where he's very gentle and very gracious. And there's times where he's blunt and uses a hammer. And you're going to see that. And he's much like Jesus in that respect. Because what you had in this church was apparently a mix of some poor or middle class to poor, and then some rich or fairly well off. And what was an interesting dynamic here is that the rich and the well off were taking advantage of the others. But in a weird twist, those who were being taken advantage of were trying to cater the favor of and treating these rich and the more prominent with favor. And yet neglecting people just like themselves. The example, we'll see this as we get into it, was when James basically says, so there you are, you're sitting in the, probably a synagogue, you're sitting in the synagogue there, and somebody comes in with ring and a nice looking outfit, and you basically say, come here, have the best seat in the house. But then somebody comes in who's poor, and you say, here, sit on my footstool. In other words, not even giving them a chair, but they can sit on the footstool where you put your dirty feet usually. He's like, does this make any sense? Because these people are oppressing you. And look at how you're treating them and how you're treating those just like you. And so we're going to see that throughout this letter. So again, they were a bit messy, but they were struggling too, because it was causing them to face a significant number of trials and difficulties. So again, kind of a messy book, a long list of topics. Now, because of that, because you see all these different topics, like one after another throughout this book, one of the things you're probably going to find is if you pull a commentary off the shelf, most of the time what they'll say is, there's just not a whole lot of structure to the book of James. It's just kind of, a hodgepodge list of topics and everything else, you know? And they liken it to something like the book of Proverbs. It's just little pithy statements here and there that James does. I completely disagree. Completely disagree. I think James is an extremely structured book. And so we're going to approach it that way. I think those that take that approach miss the point. I'm going to show you why. I'm going to give you kind of what I'm going to be using as our outline for the book of James. And partly because I think you'll see as I lay it out this way, why it's laid out this way. You know how most of the time, if you look at, say, Paul's epistles, there's always two sections to his letters, okay? The first part of the book is always the theology. He just lays out the theology. And then he gets into the practical application, which makes sense, right? Tell us what we need to know, and then tell us how to apply it. James does sort of something very similar here. Remember, they're really struggling. They're having a hard time. And so right out of the gate, the first thing we see is that James talks about trials. We get that in the first 18 verses or so. So he starts off with his greeting in verses 1 and 1 and a half there. But then he jumps right into what I'm going to call the theology, which is how to handle trials. Some would say he addresses trials and temptations. It's the exact same word. But for the first 18 verses or so, he really explains to them how to handle trials. And he tells them the right way to handle trials and the wrong way to handle trials. The right way is to consider it joy. The wrong way is to blame God for it. That's a summary. Okay? So he immediately comes out and says, we're going to deal with trials. Ultimately, you're facing all this stuff because of your behavior. So he lays down the theology. Here's how you're going to approach your trials. If you can get that under your skin, God will use it to grow you and mature you. So he does that. And then we get this kind of a strange verse that sticks out of nowhere in verse 19. He says, this you know, my beloved brethren, but everyone must be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. Another way to translate that is take note of this. And the reason for that is the way that that starts off, in Greek, you've got basically the indicative form and something called an imperative. An indicative is a statement of fact. You know this. The imperative is a command. Take note of this or know this. The problem is they're the exact same form. When you look at the word, you can't tell if it's indicative or imperative. It's either a command or a statement of fact. The context has to determine what it is. I believe in this case, James is saying, take note of this, and then what does he tell them? Be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. I think that's an outline of the book. I think James is telling them what to do in the rest of this letter. But he's also giving them, basically, something to hang their hat on. If they don't remember all the minor details of the rest of the book, the rest of the letter, if you just remember to live your life by being quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to anger, you'll make it through trials. Because that applies to everything. Quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. It's a great little thing to hang your hat on, right? So he's giving them the theology first, and then he's giving them this easy way to sort of remember how to live their lives. But here's the thing. He's a Jew, writing to Jews. Matt, what are the words for hear and obey in Hebrew? Do you remember? Pretty much the same word, right?
Shema.
It's the same word. Hear and obey. Same word. When God says listen, what does he mean?
Pay attention and obey.
James says, be quick to listen. The very first section that James deals with now, it goes from verse 8 or verse 20 all the way to the end of chapter 22. I mean, all the way through chapter 2. He challenges his readers to become doers of the word and to do it impartially. So when James says, be quick to listen, another way to translate that is be quick to obey. And so the very first section he deals with now, all the way through the rest of chapter 2, is become a doer of the word. Obey the word and obey it impartially. The next section is chapter 3. Starts off with, let not many of you become teachers. But then he also gets into talking about their tongue, saying, not everyone should be a teacher because we don't even know how to control our tongues. Well, the second thing he says in verse 9 is be slow to speak. And what does he do in chapter 3? Tells him not everybody ought to be speaking as a teacher, and you ought to learn how to use your tongue. And then the third thing he says is, Be slow to anger, chapters 4 and 5, deals with the quarrels and the conflicts and the anger and the bitterness that they had with them. So what we end up with for a structure of the letter is the first 18 verses are the theology, how to handle trials. Then he gives us a little statement about, okay, the rest of the letter, this is about being quick to listen or obey, slow to speak, which includes teachers, not getting after teaching what they shouldn't be teaching, but also you and how you control your tongue. Be slow to speak. And then lastly, be slow to anger. And again, that last section of the book is all about their anger and their wrath. He starts off, what's the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? So I think there's a tremendous amount of structure to this letter. I don't think it's just a bunch of hodgepodge stuff. Now, within that, all the other little topics he deals with, because some of them involve not being a doer of the word. Some of them involve their tongue and who's teaching and who shouldn't be teaching. Some of them involve the quarrels and the conflicts and the greed and the rich and the poor and the struggles and all of that kind of stuff. And it's interesting how be slow to anger. That whole last section, the last thing he deals with is learning to be patient. Isn't that the opposite of anger? So I think it's an extremely structured book. I don't think it's just a bunch of popcorn topics thrown out there like the book of Proverbs. I think James has some method to his madness. So we're going to walk through that, and you'll see how some of this fits in, because he covers, again, those individual topics within the larger, broader topic. So when he gets into, I want you to be quick to listen, I want you to be quick to obey. And again, he's going to talk about being a doer of the word. He's going to talk about how real religion is caring for widows and orphans. That's being a doer of what the word says when it comes to caring for widows and orphans. He's going to talk about impartiality, not treating people impartially and, you know, treating this person according to the law or according to Christ and not this person. He's going to get into the discussion of faith versus works as a part of what does it mean to be a doer of the word. So all those little individual topics we've talked about are going to fit into these larger, broader categories. Does that make sense? So that's what we're actually going to do. So again, you may see if you have a commentary or your study notes in a study Bible may kind of go a different direction and say there's not much structure to it. But again, I think we'll see this. There's a tremendous amount of structure to it. Now, before we actually finish up this morning, and we're almost done here, it would be appropriate for us to talk about the controversies. There's primarily one overarching controversy with James. And it's the contradiction or supposed contradiction between James and Paul. Turn to James chapter 2. James chapter 2, verse 14. Probably the most controversial section in all the book of James. James chapter 2, verse 4. James chapter 2, verse 14. What use is it, my brethren, if someone says that he has faith and he has no works? Can that faith save him? The implication being there that if you don't have works, you can't be saved, right? If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warm, be filled, and yet do not give them what is necessary for their body, what use is that? Even so, faith, if it has no works, is dead, being by itself. But someone may well say, you have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith without the works, and I will show you my faith by my works. You could read the rest of that on your own, but basically what he appears to say here, verse 22, you see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected. And he goes on and talks about Abraham. So those words have often been interpreted by James as saying there needs to be works. Works play a role in saving you. That's the controversy. Anybody remember what Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 and 9 says? Yeah. So, gosh darn it, James and Paul don't agree. They don't agree. There's tension. You couldn't get them in the same room together. It'd come to blows, right? Paul is saying, no, works have nothing to do with faith. James says, oh, no, faith has not. You have to have works. That's the controversy. In fact, it's one of the reasons why Martin Luther didn't believe that the book of James should be in our New Testament canon. In fact, he referred to it as an epistle of straw. Now, he didn't quite go so far as to remove it. In fact, in his own German translation of the New Testament, he did include the letter of James, but reluctantly, because he really didn't believe that James should be in our New Testament. Because as he read James, too much emphasis on works, and he believed that James was in conflict with Paul. So that's the controversy. There's no controversy. I'm going to take an approach on this controversy in this discussion. And it partly hinges on what does it mean when you see the word saved in the New Testament. We all think it's always about salvation from hell. But it's not. It's used to be rescued and delivered, including rescued and delivered from trials. If we really understand what James is doing here, he's trying to help them make it through trials and difficult times by living out their faith. And so one of the ways to look at this is to understand, we have to ask ourselves the question, when James is talking about faith and works here, is he talking about salvation from hell, or is he talking about salvation through the trials and the difficulties they had created by not living out their faith in Christ, by not being doers of the word? And I believe that that's probably a better way to understand what James is saying. He's not talking about salvation from hell. He's really talking about salvation and deliverance here and now. That faith, when it doesn't have any works, cannot rescue or deliver us today from anything in this life. It can't get us through difficulties and trials. And again, there is evidence of that throughout the scriptures, the way this word is used. So they're not in conflict with one another, because James's perspective isn't specifically on hell. Paul in Ephesians is talking about eternal salvation, salvation from hell or the lake of fire. And works plays no role in that. We're saved by grace so that we can't boast. But we all know that when it comes to this life here, if we don't exercise faith, if we don't put our faith into action, if we don't become a doer of the word, even the Old Testament tells us the way of the wicked is difficult. There is no hope in this life of making it through difficulties if our faith doesn't have feet to it. I believe that's what James is really talking about there. And so we'll get into that, and I'll make my case for that as we go through it. But there is no controversy there. It's a misunderstanding of what James is saying. And I think mostly because when we see that word saved, we immediately think of only salvation from hell. When we see the word faith, we only think of faith that saves us from hell, not faith that saves us from trials and difficulties today. And James, the emphasis, if we look at the letter, he is talking to people who are hurting, they're struggling, they're a mess, they're bickering, they're fighting, and he's trying to help them get through that and help them understand the role that faith plays in that. And it can only be a faith that has works connected to it. Does that make sense? So I don't think there's a controversy. And most don't today either. They find different ways to sort of resolve it, you know. But anyway, so that's what we're looking at for this letter as we go forward. We'll start next week getting into the first section, which is how to handle trials correctly. And we'll try to again make it somewhat interactive and everything else. So you're always able to throw your hand up or ask a question or make a comment if you want to. We'll do our best to make this very, very interactive. All right?